start out on Senate Bill 729, and we have Randall Elmer and Catherine Olney and Jennifer Weber. You guys wanted to, can you come together? Are you friendly enough that you can sit close to each other, or do you need to come separately? Can you? Okay. Yeah. Well, you're sitting down. I did want to announce on Senate Bill 1048 that we will not hear it tonight. It's not been through the MLAC process yet, and it also has a problem, I understand, with the reading clause. So that one we will not hear this evening. So please go ahead.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes. For the record, my name is Jennifer Weber. I represent the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys and the Workers' Comp section of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We have had Senate Bill 729 introduced by Senator Corcoran at our request, and Randy Elmer is going to tell you about it, but I would just like to share that we have taken this bill before the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and it was approved by MLAC with no opposition, and so we appreciate your consideration of the bill this evening.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Elmer. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I've been practicing law for 16 years as a workers' compensation claimant's attorney, and I've also been serving for the last 2 or 3 years as the president of the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. We're here to support Senate Bill 729 and to urge you to pass it out with a favorable vote. What this bill does is it amends ORS 656212 sub 2, the temporary partial disability provision, to take out the 2-year cap that has been in this law since at least 1953. It seems at this point in time that it's somewhat archaic and unnecessary, and unfortunately does result sometimes in some pretty harsh and unjust results to workers, especially those workers who are on very serious claims with extended open periods where time loss is being paid. I think to help you to understand this, I'd like to just distinguish very quickly between the forms of time loss we pay in the system. We pay what's called temporary total disability when the worker has no release to work, no capacity to perform any kind of modified work, and he gets a full 2/3 of the average wage earned at injury. Now, when there's some modified release indicating that there's some capacity to work, then in those periods of time, what the worker's being paid is what's called temporary partial disability. Now, that may be paid at the full rate the temporary total is if there's no work offered and they're not earning any wages, but the period will be labeled as the period of temporary partial disability. Now, in a very serious case, let's say, for example, multiple amputee or a very serious crush injury to both feet or something that may require multiple surgeries, what you may see is over a number of years, there's periods of time, maybe between the surgeries, where the insurer will seek a release, a modified release, primarily to allow the worker to participate in voc rehab without delaying that every time he's able to participate. Let's keep going with the testing and figuring out where we're going. And it may, in fact, occur that over a long period of time, a lot of that time loss that's paid will be labeled temporary partial disability where there was no contemplation by the worker or the employer of the employee returning to work and earning any wages. Now, however, you get to the end of this claim, and now they're figuring whether you're going to get paid for those amputated body parts. All of the money that's been paid and labeled temporary partial disability beyond 2 years is now an overpayment, and in many cases will result in it completely wiping out that permanent partial disability award. Now, what we suggest is there's really no rational reason to put a cap on temporary partial disability. We've never put a cap on temporary total disability for those workers who are completely unable to work at all, and there's really no rational justification for putting that same kind of a cap on someone who's just partially disabled. So we urge you to pass the bill out with a favorable vote. Thank you.
Why do you think it originally was put on?
I'll be perfectly honest with you, Senator Gerpler. I've been making calls to some of my colleagues who have practiced for many years, longer than I have. In fact, a defense attorney earlier today who pulled out an old leather-bound volume of a 1965 work written by a person named Lackey that was at one time thought in the mid-60s to be the Bible on the history of Oregon workers' compensation. And he offered to look that up for me, and he said, well, I'm to that portion of his book, and it just simply says there's a two-year cap, and here's the current version of the statute. And I also looked at cases as old as 1923 discussing temporary partial disability, and there's nowhere in the cases I read any discussion of the legislative history or the rationale behind why that was put into the law. I guess one can assume that in 1953 or probably before, we didn't have all the administrative rules and statutory protections that are given to the insurers and employers as we now have that would help them to get someone with a modified release back to work. And I can only assume it was probably some kind of a method of giving incentive to someone who has a modified release and some capacity to work to look a little harder for that work. Now, of course, if a modified job is found for the worker and the worker refuses it, the worker will lose his or her time off, and the insurer has every right to cut it off. So they must go ahead and take the job their doctor signs off on. There's administrative rules that allow that to happen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Almey, and I am not a member of OTLA. I come to you tonight representing Liberty Northwest Insurance, and I've been a defense attorney for 10 years. Liberty comes here tonight to support this amendment as well. I talked this morning to the vice president, who is in charge of all of our claims management, and got some information from him. He tells me that in 1998, Liberty received 4,795 new claims in which time loss in some method or manner was paid. They don't even keep statistics on what comes next, but it was their estimate that of all of those in the whole year, probably only two or three would have been affected by this statute or by the change in the statute. It just doesn't come up too often that we get someone who actually goes on modified time loss or temporary partial time loss for more than 2 years. In fact, in the over 10 years that I've worked for Liberty, I've only ever had one case in which this came up that I was asked to litigate. In the face of this, Liberty perceives that the proposed amendment to be a small economic consequence to the insured. I would agree with Mr. Elmer that now with all of the other administrative rules and statutes, we consider that we have plenty of tools to manage the more difficult claims in which perhaps motivation is an issue, so that it doesn't need to be used in that way for us anymore. And we believe that if it helps a few more injured workers return to the workforce, then it's a reasonable and fair change to make.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Does anyone else wish to talk on 10-0-7-29? You want to? We're always glad to have you. You're just sitting alongside the table as well. But.
I need temporary commercial disability.
Uh-oh. You got a worker talk, Wayne?
Back operation that didn't go well.
Didn't it?
I'm Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council, and I'm the co-chairman of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. Mr. Elmer talked about those people who use temporary partial disability through the voc rehab system, which is more typical of what we're probably talking about here, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to share with the committee that over the last few years, because of the legislature and in more enlightenment amongst the insurer and employer community, that a lot of injured workers are now using time loss or temporary partial disability for early return to work programs that we never used to do before. I can envision people with pretty serious injuries. Remember, this bill, it has to do with the life of the claim, so that there are probably a handful, and I'm glad that the lady from Liberty said their experience was two or three, but there may be people with serious injuries who utilize early return to work programs, and through the life of that claim, perhaps would hit up to that two-year period. And I'd like to remind the committee, if they're not doing early return to work, they're probably sitting at home, and that was the last thing that we wanted people to do. was that as long as the attending physician said they could do some modified work, not to hurt themselves, but get back in the workplace amongst their coworkers, that was one of the best things that we could do. So that's one of the reasons we supported the bill as well, is that it really enhances what the legislature intended all along for early return to work programs, so that people are back amongst their coworkers. And it's probably very few people, but it would remove a hurdle. I'm guessing now that if it was in place for those people who really hurt bad and they ran up against the 2-year, you might have a situation where they simply are sent home and drawing full-time loss because they can't work, and then you've got this artificial statutory hurdle there. So we think it's a good public policy to remove this hurdle and do what we always intended.
Did you just ask to see our fix on the other one that we have, the workers are not getting their medicals?
I had a very long discussion with Meg this afternoon and applaud the efforts of that little work group, and that would be a tremendous thing to do. That's also something that is so illogical in our system today, where people are not getting needed medical treatment. By the time the system gets done with them, they could have already been back to work.
Yeah.
That's the experience I've had with my employers.
Yeah. I think we've got a call.
I hope so. And I told her if there's anything I can do to help you and her with that, I'd be more than happy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Any questions? So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729 and open the work session on 729.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
What are this going to say? I'll move Senate Bill 729 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Is there, maybe we're going to take a voice count because our vice chair doesn't like it.
No.
No objection.
A roll call.
Oh, okay. That's not what I thought you were saying. Gotcha. Okay.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Peterson?
Aye.
Senator Gates?
Aye.
Senator Griffin?
Aye. Very. I'm going to be nice if it's all right to let Mr. Corcoran. I think I'll treat him nicer than he would me, but I'll let him carry the ball.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1198. Do we have people signed up today? Okay, we have Chris Davey, Steve Telfer, and Fred Benetta. You'd want to come together with the... appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. This evening in support of Senate Bill 1198, also with a dash one amendment that I'll come to in a little while. Safe Corporation today writes workers' compensation insurance as a public corporation. We have done so since 1980, with essentially no changes in our structure since that time. Over the years, various other public corporations have been created. Most recently in 1995, Oregon Health Sciences University became a public corporation. And the model for what a public corporation can do and should do has evolved over the years. In the case of OHSU, the legislature recognized that they were competing with private health care providers and needed the additional operating flexibility that came with being a public corporation. What Senate Bill 1198 does is make some technical changes to SAFE's relationship with other state entities and is modeled principally on the language that has already been adopted and implemented in Senate Bill 2 from 1995, which was the OHSU bill. This bill does not change SAFE's mission in any way. It does not expand SAFE's authority to write other lines of insurance, and it does not allow SAFE to insure employers in other states. There are five principal objectives to this bill. This one is offering an alternative to PERS for new employees. Secondly, requiring the state treasurer to consult with SAFE on how SAFE's assets are invested. Third, allowing SAFE to use private counsel. Fourth, exempting sensitive business records from public disclosure and some of the SAFE Board of Directors' deliberations from the public meetings law. And fifth, making SAFE subject to additional regulation under the insurance code, and I'll deal with each of those issues. First of all, PERS. As the committee certainly knows, PERS is a very good retirement benefit for those people who are subject to it, but it comes at a fairly high cost to the employer who has to pay that annual assessment. What we're finding is that in today's marketplace, employees tend to place a little less value on a high retirement benefit. They generally expect to be, they don't expect to be with a single employer for the whole of their working life, and they would prefer to have a more portable benefit option. Sometimes with younger employers, employees, their short-term financial needs are such that they would rather have a higher salary and a less generous contribution to the retirement program. We are not able to offer that alternative today. If an employee comes to work for SAFE, they are a PERS employee and there is no option. What we would like to do is to have the flexibility to offer an alternative to new employees who would prefer to have a different form of retirement package. We don't have any immediate plans for an alternative. There's nothing sitting in the wings. But we just like to have the flexibility to do that.
My understanding is it doesn't have to be equal to a PERS program.
Mr. Chair, this bill doesn't address that. It simply says that we would have the option to offer an alternative to PERS.
Because as I recall, if you offer that, then it has to be a plan as good as or equal to, but I'm not sure in this case that would apply.
I'm not sure about that either.
Okay.
OHSU may offer an alternative to PERS that was included in their bill.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether there was language there that said the equal to provision.
Okay.
Secondly, on investment policy, the state treasurer invests all of SAFE's monies today. Currently, that's about $2.3 billion. And we've asked for a greater voice in how those investments are made and where those investments are placed. We've discussed that issue with the state treasurer and agreed on the language that's in Section 5 of the bill, which provides for collaboration and cooperation between the SAFE Board and the Oregon Investment Council on how SAFE's investments are managed. And again, by contrast with OHSU, they are free at this point to manage their own investments separately from the state treasurer and the investment council. Private counsel. Currently, SAFE is required to obtain all its legal services from the Department of Justice. And this bill would enable SAFE to obtain private counsel when that's considered necessary. The Department of Justice is set up to provide advice to state agencies which operate with tax dollars in the public sector. It is not designed to provide legal advice to public entities operating in a competitive environment or to meet the special needs of an insurance operation. We often require expertise in specialized areas not usually covered by the department, such as bankruptcy law, managed care, and this bill would enable us to obtain the most appropriate services to protect the assets of the Industrial Accident Fund. Oregon Health Sciences University is also permitted to use to hire their own counsel. This provision in Senate Bill 1198 is based on that language. This has been previously discussed with the Attorney General, and it has been our understanding that he's not opposed to this bill. He is here tonight, and he may speak to that. This does not change, incidentally, the defense of workers' compensation claims. We have already, for many years, we've had an arrangement with the Department of Justice where SAFE employees actually do the defense of claims, and they are given some special designation by the Department of Justice. So we're really only talking about specialized legal representation of the general counsel variety, and my understanding is that that only affects one or two FTE currently within the Department of Justice. Sensitive records and public meetings, once again, this language is taken almost word for word from the bill for OHSU. Today we're subject to the same standards as any state agency, and there would be nothing to prevent our competitors, for example, coming to one of our board meetings and listening in on discussions about marketing plans and such things. The bill that we have here exempts sensitive business records that would not ordinarily be available to a competitor, and the discussion of those issues at a public board meeting. Once again, the records exemption is identical to the language for OHSU. And then the final part of this bill deals with the insurance code, and for many years there's been some debate about whether states should be subject to the same regulation as other insurance companies. The way that it's put together now is sort of haphazard. A lot of the statutes that are in place today date back to before SAFE, while SAFE was the only insurer for workers' compensation and before the three-way system was created. When it was created, the SAFE was left with some separate kind of regulation while insurance companies came under their own regulation. And then in 1980, when SAFE became a public corporation, again, there should have been a little more cleaning up of those statutes and regulation, and it hasn't happened. Some years ago, the department did propose bringing SAFE under essentially the same regulation as private insurance companies. And what we've done in this bill is to take that proposal, but even go one step further and volunteer to be subject to even more provisions of the insurance code. And we've got a list that goes on now for several pages of the things that we would become subject to. It doesn't make any substantive change in how SAFE operates, and this has also allowed us to repeal a lot of old statutes that speak specifically to how SAFE will do things and creates a separate way for SAFE to collect premiums, for example. We think it'd be in the best interest of everyone if we had a common way of being regulated in that area, and so we are suggesting repeal of those special sections, and SAFE would be subject to the same rules as any other insurance company. Once again, we've reviewed these amendments with the insurance division, and they've concurred that these are appropriate revisions to the insurance code. So, in conclusion, this bill does not plow any new ground. It adopts some of the same concepts and statutory language that have already been implemented at OHSU. In fact, OHSU statute goes much further, and OHSU has much looser powers to the state than SAFE does now or will have under this bill. It keeps SAFE status as a unique component of the state of Oregon with a public purpose, and it assures that we'll have the necessary operating flexibility to achieve our public mission, making insurance as available and affordable as possible. If I could quickly refer to the Dash 1 amendment, this is simply an error in drafting, and I think that you have before you an amended page 9 that shows the effect of that amendment. If you would like, Mr. Chair, I can go through the bill section by section and tell you what those sections do, or I can take questions as you prefer.
Yeah. I don't think we need to go through. So I think you did a fairly complete job of explaining what the bill does, and I think that's like the. I don't think we need to go through section by section. That's what the committee wants them to do. That. Any desire to have that? Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Just for clarification, I just don't know the answer to these. Are SAFE employees considered state employees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Q-Tub, SAFE employees are not part of the state personnel system. They are state employees. There's always a lot of debate about when you speak about state, does SAFE come under the state? And for the most part, the answer to that is yes. But if your question is, do we come under the state personnel rules, salary structures, and so on, the answer to that is no.
Do they have a bargaining unit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Q-Tub, no, we do not.
Okay, let's hear the other side.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Steve Telfer. I'm here representing the Alliance of American Insurers. The Alliance opposes Senate Bill 1198 because we believe if it's enacted, SAFE would end up behaving more like a private insurer than its current public corporation status permits, while not having the same regulatory and tax requirements as other insurers do. We just heard from Chris that they are voluntarily attempting to come under the insurance code. Frankly, the list is so long I've not had a chance to go through and look at each and every section, and I'll take him at his word that indeed that's the case. Nevertheless, SAFE, because of its long history going back to 1913, has accumulated the Industrial Accident Fund, and it's our belief that the earnings, the investment earnings on those funds, give it a tremendous asset that is not taxed as our private insurers. And so there is some evidence that we've heard through a variety of hearings so far in this session that SAFE's largesse is, in fact, creating market instability. I've got three questions I'd like to pose for the consideration in the committee. One, I guess, is should SAFE use those earnings from this Industrial Accident Fund reserve to apply toward pension contributions for future employees, if the act becomes law? Two, why should what is now a public corporation be able to go out and get private legal counsel? I mean, it seems to me we've as a matter of policy, always set up public state agencies and public corporations get their legal services from the Attorney General. Is this just to save money, or is there another more practical reason that we aren't aware of?
I think what I heard Chris say was that in some cases the Attorney General doesn't have qualified attorneys, perhaps, or have as much ability to kind of a special need.
But as I understand it, and certainly the Attorney General, who was in the audience, may still be, can speak for himself, I think they have provisions now within their office to seek and retain special counsel in those circumstances that they feel is necessary.
And then let me ask you on the pension, if you apply the earnings from the trust fund to the pension, wouldn't that just reduce their cost in salaries or in
well,
wouldn't it just be an offset?
In the context of SAFE, nobody knows where the dollar comes from. We don't know what the pension benefits might be in the future. We don't know whether it will be a 401k look-alike. It could be some other private arrangement that could look like a stock-sharing arrangement, even though it isn't a stock company. It could be any of a number of things. It's uncertain. And I guess our only question is it appropriate that funds or earnings on funds that came out of the Industrial Accident Fund be used in part for that contribution purpose? Third, if these changes are appropriate, I guess we ask the fundamental question, why not get on with mutualizing the SAFE Corporation and putting it under the same rules of the road as all other companies and move ahead? And in fact, we would urge this committee and the rest of the legislature to take a good serious look at SAFE and the marketplace and see whether maybe this isn't the time to address the question of either privatizing SAFE altogether or conversely maybe moving it back to state agency status. But this kind of never land patterned after the OHSU thing just to us doesn't make sense because you've got the tax-free status on earnings on the one hand and some questionable state about the regulation on the other. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Any questions? If SAFE were neutralized and placed under the same tax and regulatory requirements as other insurers, would the premiums for other employers be similar? Do you think competing with other insurance companies would keep premiums at a level that would be near to what they are with SAFE now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Keetub, obviously there's no way for me to know precisely what the impact that would be, but I think in the long haul, a marketplace all operating under the same rules and with the same tax structure is going to tend to be more competitive. We have been very fortunate in Oregon and, for that matter, across the country in the last few years because we've had a splendid economy. We've had reforms, workers' comp reforms, that have had a major contributing impact on lowering rates. Investment earnings are at an all-time historical high, but these are cycles, and somewhere along the line, that cycle is bound to reverse. And I think our real concern, candidly, is that if you look at the market concentration with SAFE and Liberty Northwest today and without the tax requirement imposed on SAFE portion of that business, we could end up in the long haul having a very unstable market. I don't know that that answers your question, and I can't tell you. Because I'm not an actuary by any stretch of the imagination, what the immediate impact of rates would be upon mutualization.
And I guess I'm not really asking for a real exact answer. I'm asking for as much knowledge as anybody would have. That's really how I'm asking it. As a general, does it make sense? Would that happen? Sort of thing.
See, my question is, if you mutualize space, that, of course, that would be owned by the policy holders.
Right.
And they would redistribute those dollars back to, so it's still not going to pay any taxes. Would that be correct if they distributed all the earnings back to the
policyholders? It would not be like a stock company where there were shareholders involved and you were paying dividends to shareholders. In this case, it would simply be owned by the policyholders. And dividends that accrue as a result of surpluses beyond those necessary to meet the reserves would flow back to the policyholders as much as they do now. But investment earnings, and again, this is the big nub of this thing. There's, in 1997, I think it was, there's about $192 million of investment gain that were not taxed, federal taxed. As contrasted with similar gains made by other insurers that are taxed, and so you've got this inequity. Now, in a mutualized situation, those gains indeed would be taxed. And you could argue, well, gee, you're going to just send that off to our federal government.
Who would collect the tax over in Washington?
But it would create, in our opinion, a much more level playing field and a competitive market that was truly based on everybody operating the same stake.
But my understanding is that insurance companies that do have those invest them in different ways so they're not taxable. Is that correct?
You will hear, Mr. Chair, that some companies will allocate the assets that they have available in their reserves so that a portion will be invested in government, otherwise tax-exempt securities to avoid taxes. But I think if you look at the total reserves, any prudent person is going to look at all kinds of asset classes and invest them in a way that will maximize return within the context of the risk that they want to reward. And that isn't always going to be tax-exempt instruments.
So if you mutualize a company and the earnings on the trust fund were taxable, and that would go back to as an income tax to the state, let's say Washington, D.C.,
right,
and it would raise the cost, then I'd save that many dollars.
Right.
That's kind of what would happen.
Right.
So it would raise the cost of doing business for state.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Vanilla.
Resonata, appearing before you tonight on behalf of Liberty Northwest Company, we would concur that paying taxes raises the cost of doing business. That's not something that we
agree with.
Not a point that we would argue. We have both a puzzlement and a concern about Senate Bill 1198. First, I'll express what we're puzzled about and then turn to the concerns. SAFE is a state-owned entity that has accumulated hundreds of millions of dollars. Your insurance commissioner report suggests it has a surplus of over $300 million. Senate Bill 1198 opens that money up to future employees for retirement benefits, apparently to be used without limitations, review, or restraint. Oregon has a pretty good PERS system, which SAFE employees enjoy at the present time. It's puzzling why it would be a good policy to open the Industrial Accident Fund to future employees without the restraint of legislative review or the natural restraints that occur in the private sector, those natural restraints being taxes and the necessity of maintaining shareholder returns, neither of which restraints would occur under a circumstance with SAFE. Now, that's our puzzlement. Let's turn to our concerns. This legislation clearly establishes a system where the state will be suing the state. That is prevented now because both the regulator, DCBS, and SAFE get the same legal advice, or at least they should. This system may provide dramatically different legal advice. I've not examined the DCBS budgeting process, but I'll bet my clients will wind up paying the DCS Department of Consumer and Business Services legal bill in any such confrontations. And this leads to a very serious concern. It's no secret that SAFE wants to get into other lines of insurance. Our lawyers have not been able to find for me a clear statutory limitation that workers' compensation insurance and reinsurance and employer liability insurance are the only lines SAFE can write. It's interesting to observe that this bill specifically allows SAFE to form or acquire subsidiary corporations. You don't need a subsidiary corporation to write workers' compensation insurance, but with a little friendly advice, you might well be able to use a subsidiary corporation to write other lines of insurance. There's an interim study of the Oregon workers' compensation marketplace presently being considered by the House of Representatives. The issues in this bill would be a good addition to that study. It's interesting that in Texas there's a similar situation as there is in the Oregon workers' comp marketplace, although the Texas State Fund is not nearly as predatory as the State Fund is here. The legislature there has been having hearings on a bill that would strip the surplus from the State Fund and change their mission to one of stabilizing the workers' comp marketplace rather than being a competitive force. Although I recognize the different level of commitment to the free enterprise system in Oregon and Texas, it's interesting that here we are considering legislation that may greatly broaden the state fund's authority rather than limit it. The question I would pose to the committee is, do we want a competitive market for workers' compensation in Oregon, or do we want to return to a monopoly market? We oppose the bill suggested to be placed in a study.
Thank you,
sir. Any
questions?
Yes, let's just go ahead, please. Thank you. Mr. Damiata, where does it say that they're allowed to purchase or acquire others?
Page 9, lines 13, 14, 15, and 16, starting in the about a third of the way through line 13.
You're right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Nice to have an evening meeting because nobody wants to talk.
Mr. Chair, could I just respond to that last point?
Okay.
SAFE Corporation today can form subsidiary companies. In fact, we used to have a subsidiary 10, 15 years ago that was called SAFE Corporation of Oregon. Because of the way that pricing was structured back then, there wasn't an opportunity, as I remember, to have different tiers of prices within a single company. And so we created a subsidiary when the pricing mechanism changed, the subsidiary was dissolved. Hasn't been used since, but it's in the statute today. So this bill does not create new opportunities for subsidiary companies. The reference here simply says that whatever standards apply to the officers and employees of SAFE would apply to any subsidiaries that were created. It doesn't give any new right to create a subsidiary.
Could you presently do a subsidiary and sell other types of insurance? You have that ability right now?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that we could. The statute, as I recall, says the SAFE Corporation is created for the purpose of selling workers' compensation insurance. The idea that we could go into other lines of insurance just isn't borne out by the statute. And we would not have the authority to create a subsidiary to do something that was different from what our basic statutory charge was.
Okay. Any other comments from anybody?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, if you choose to go forward with this legislation, putting a specific prohibition, a clear and precise prohibition in the statute on other lines would certainly reduce the level of anxiety that this legislation creates.
So if we choose to go forward, if you'll have an opportunity to make an amendment to that.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you all for your time. Harvey Myers, but we should have had you up first, Harvey. I'm sorry that since you're one of the distinguished people within the state, we should have...
I'm not working in any new office, sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Durfler, members of the committee. I'm Harvey Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate your allowing me to offer some testimony in respect to Senate Bill 1198, and specifically Section 4, Subsection 3, dealing with attorney services. Now, at the outset, I want to express my regret to the committee, as I have already to the state representative, about an apparent misunderstanding as to the department's position on this issue. Now, I'll be candid, I don't know how much more I can say to you at this point about how such a thing might have occurred without perhaps violating attorney-client privilege. So if I may, Mr. Chair, I would like to try to sort that out with Ms. Keene and Mr. Jones. But again, I simply want to assert to the committee that there is a misunderstanding.
Okay.
Now, under this bill, SAFE continues in really all essentials its present relationship with the state. It remains a public entity, a public corporation, and it has been the legislature's overall judgment, as expressed in Chapter 180, that entities in that relationship should receive centralized legal services, which are ultimately under the control of the Attorney General. Now, SAFE presents, in some respects, a bit of a unique problem because they do have, within their total activities, services to private employers and services to the state. They are the workers' compensation service writer for the state, as I'm sure you all know. And with the troubled, sometimes troubled relationship between the Department of Justice and SAFE that I think goes back to the early 1980s when the legislature removed certain funds from SAFE as a strategy to balance the budget, and there then ensued an all-out battle between Attorney General Frommeyer and SAFE as to whether SAFE was entitled to go out and get its own lawyers to contest that issue, whether they were subject to 180. Attorney General Frommeyer had to litigate the 180 issue, and ultimately he won that issue. The Supreme Court held that SAFE was subject to Chapter 180 and the control of legal services under the Attorney General. Ultimately, with that having been resolved, the litigation involving the question of the removal of the funds went forward, and SAFE ultimately won. As you all know, and you are paying the last installment this session, I think, of the award that was obtained in that Alcee Vanier litigation, $80 million, I think, is the last installment. So this was an expensive mistake, and I have to say I was part of it. I was here at the time. But with that troubled background, there has been difficulty off and on through the years between the department and SAFE. And we have tried to, I think, particularly in recognition of the fact that they serve both private interests, private employers, and the state, we have tried to arrive at a modus operandi with SAFE with respect to legal services that we think can reasonably accommodate that fact to the overall policy of 180. Now, essentially what we have done is to prescribe that the overall legal services of SAFE remain under the Attorney General. But the SAFE may provide, really through what I would call conflict counsel, not Special Assistant Attorney General, their own counsel, they provide legal representation to private employers as to cases in which they are the insured. And really the only right that we retain in the agreement as to those cases, I think, is that if there is an appeal from one of those cases, and the legal position that SAFE is asserting in that appeal is one that we disagree with, SAFE agrees under our arrangement they will not object to the state entering that appeal for purposes of asserting the state's position on the law. But as to cases involving state agency insurers, the Attorney General under the agreement retains ultimate and full control of those legal services and control over appeals from cases involving state agency insurance. So the agreement draws that distinction between private insureds SAFE is serving and the agencies of the state government. Now, and then as I said, the overall general counsel responsibilities and needs of SAFE are retained under the ultimate control of the Attorney General. And I think as to that and as to the issue of whether at times the department has the requisite expertise to handle the questions at hand, I guess the most I could say at this point is that if either SAFE or the department believe that there is a need to obtain additional expertise, as has already been noted, 180 gives the Attorney General the authority to obtain a supplemental outside counsel. And that's routinely done in many different situations by the department in areas, in certain subject areas.
How would that be your decision to make whether they could go outside? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So they would have to get your approval to go outside?
Yes. Okay. That is the way 180 now structures it, Chair Griffin.
Thank you.
Now, may I go to the language of the bill for a moment and direct your attention to it at the bottom of page 1, because as I understood the testimony from SAFE, the intention is to not disturb the present arrangement with respect to compensation cases. That's what I thought. But if you look at this language, it says, notwithstanding OS Chapter 180 or any other provision, attorneys employed or retained by the corporation shall represent the corporation and its officers and employees in all matters. And attorneys employed or retained by the corporation shall be provided by the corporation to employers, insured by the corporation, in matters in which the corporation is required to provide representation. So I don't know if the language wasn't drafted in the way it was intended, but I believe this language completely ousts the Department of Justice from all involvement in SAFE legal matters, including in respect to the handling of compensation cases involving the state of Oregon.
I'm not an attorney, but that's what I do.
You have an advantage there, Thorne, I think you're absolutely right. Now, again, as I say, the language may not have been drafted in the way that it was intended, but I don't think it matches with what was said that it was intended to do. Well, we think that it is within the overall principle of unity of legal advice to state entities, it is particularly important that there continue to be Department of Justice control over the prosecution of claims and appeals from them involving the state of Oregon, because there can be, for example, issues of law arising in those cases, which may be of considerable importance to state government, as to which I think it would be really unthinkable to have independent outside counsel authorized to make the decision as to what position will be taken with respect to the meaning of those statutes as they bear on the operations of state government. Again, I'm striking that we're talking about the state agency cases here, as well as handing over to outside independent counsel, private counsel, complete control over the positions that would be taken with respect, I say, with respect to issues on appeal from those cases. And further, and I think it was Mr. Vanetta who made this point, under the present arrangement, in which we have the form of control that exists, we do have the ability to avoid interagency disputes as to the meaning of law, at least in cases involving state agencies and employees, that is to say, disputes between SAFE and PCDS, because when there is that disagreement, then the Department of Justice will resolve it, and there will be a unified position with respect to the issue at hand, meaning of either the workers' compensation statutes or to DCDS rules. So it would be my hope, Mr. Chair and members, that whatever other portions of this measure you might be inclined to recommend to the Senate for approval, I would really earnestly hope that you would not at this point choose to go down the path that's prescribed in subsection 4, or section 4, subsection 3.
I guess what I hear you saying, they already have the ability to go outside of your office with your approval to get outside counsel if that's the choice they want to make, and as long as you agree with it. Is that a fair assumption of what you said?
Yes, that is a correct statement of the law. We're not going to do that lightly. And I don't know. I don't have the whole history of the relationship between the department and SAFE. Mm-hmm. And I don't know on how many different occasions there may have been a request for the department to appoint supplementary or special assistant attorneys general outside.
You couldn't tell me how often they've asked.
Pardon me?
You couldn't tell me how often they've asked.
I do not know. I could possibly try to determine that.
If it's ever been turned down or approved, you don't know that.
I could try to give you that history, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
Any questions?
Okay. in the testimony from SAFE, they noted that OHSU is permitted to hire its own counsel. Are you familiar with that, and how is it different from this?
Chair Dirkler, Senator Kutub, yes, I'm familiar with that. I was not Attorney General at the time, so I don't know what discussions may have occurred around that issue inside or outside the Department of Justice. The one distinction I would draw at the moment is that the OHSU change, as I think was acknowledged by the state representative here, was a much more sweeping disconnection of OHSU from the previous ties to the wider government that it had. And I'm not prepared to give you a comparison of that legislation to the one that's before you now, but that severance was much, much more, I think, complete and dramatic. And I think that in that total context, the notion that they would also be divorced from the relationship, pre-existing relationship with the Department of Justice, probably looked and perhaps was entirely logical, that it was part of a much larger and more sweeping divorce, if you will, from the prior relationship. I might say, too, that, and I have to go through and think about this some more, Chair Dirkler, Senator Kutub, but it may also be that in the ongoing operations of Oregon Health Sciences University, you may not have as many situations in which the determination of the state's position with respect to law are going to be as potentially important to the state government as a whole as you may have in, for example, the prosecution and resolution of workers' compensation claims, in which you may have issues that are not only important to the state in that area, but might have ramifications beyond compensation law. But that's not a comparison I can really make right now.
As long as you're here, I get some free advice. My understanding is that after the money was taken from SAFE last time and then it went to Clark County, we had to repay that back, thankfully. There was legislation passed later, at a later date that would allow the legislature to again remove surplus funds from SAFE. Are you familiar with that?
Chair Dirkler, I am not familiar with that. I don't know if this is
I thought the attorneys and lawyers answered it. Come ahead, Chris, if you had the answer to it. I thought I was going to get sort of pay $120 an hour to get some free money.
Corporation. When the bill was passed, there was a change in the statute that dealt with the state's right to take money from state corporations. But it's far from clear. It's a complex issue, and I'm not an attorney.
Well, we have one here, but maybe could you take a look at that, Hardy? I mean, where that stands. We don't want to go through another suit.
How much money are you looking for, Senator?
I'm just looking for some free advice.
I have a feeling it's a lot more than we needed in 1981. 82.
Okay. Any questions?
I'll check on that for you.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for coming this evening. We've got Jeff Jovial and Jeff Cook and Mary Bachman. We'd like to also... can you come up and sit close to him, Mary, or do you want
to...
Can't you get along for just this, maybe a half hour?
No,
oh, okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Who do you want to go first?
I'd go first. I'm going to be very brief. I'm going to be even briefer than I was going to be to start with. I'm Mary Botkin, representing AFSCME Council 75, and we were actually very closely involved with the OHSU change to a public corporation, and I've been listening pretty carefully to some of your questions, and I'm not prepared to answer some of them, but I am prepared to go back to kind of the original bill and take a look at what we did. I think that there's a couple of fundamental differences between OHSU and the SAFE Corporation. First of all, OHSU is a medical facility, and it is a predominantly a research and education facility, which requires that they have the flexibility. They made a compelling case to us as their collective bargaining agent that they had a compelling reason for the need to expand into areas and contract in areas as medical technology and medical practices changed, and their need to bring expertise in was very, very compelling, that there were areas in medical practices that required that they be allowed to bring specialized doctors and nursing staff in for short periods of time. And I think that that was primarily the reason they were allowed to offer an alternative program to PERS. It's also some of the reasons why the changes were made to a public corporation. I think that some 4 or 5 years later, we are beginning to see that there might be some reasons why it wasn't a good idea, and I think management and the union would both agree with that, that there's been some, as you know, some leftover tendency to come here for funding when it is not clear that this is where they should be coming. However, that's being dealt with down the hall in other committees, and I know Senator Q-Tub's involved in some of those discussions, as are you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, we're working our way through those issues. But I do think that there's one significant difference that is very important to remember, and that is OHSU had a union voice for its employees. As we worked through that change, those employees had an equal voice at the table, defining how the change would take place, defining how the alternative programs would be put in place, kind of discussing, and certainly not necessarily always agreeing, but certainly always working through those problems. It took us a long time of very considered hard work and diligence to come up with a bill that everybody could agree with. Senator Hartung was very helpful in crafting that bill, and it was a multi-year effort. Was not done over a period of a session. It was not done in the heat of the moment. It was done over a long, extended period of time where the union's legal counsel and the attorneys, both at DOJ and at OHSU, had the opportunity to review every step that we were taking. And most importantly, I think, is that those employees have every right to stay in PERS, and there's never been an effort to move them outside of that. And I'm not suggesting that SAFE would make that effort, but this is a company with $2 billion. This is an agency or a quasi public agency or whatever we want to call it that has a lot of money in reserves, and PERS seems hardly a problem to me for them to fund. And I guess if they go forward with this, you know, my old boss, Cecil Tibbetts, will give me a great reason to go organize their employees. But, you know, he always told me to seize opportunities when they arose, and I think that he has given me the opportunity. But, you know, in all seriousness, I do think there was a very fundamental difference, and that is that those employees did have counsel available to them. They had a voice available to them, and the union made its resources available so that they were fairly represented at the table as we worked through that process.
Well, my understanding was that it would be prospective for the new employees, but not for the present employees. Is that what you heard?
I understand that that's what's being said. I don't know that if, my attitude always is, if you don't have it in writing, it's not a signed effort, and, you've got to really make very clear that those folks are represented. and there's no collective voice for the employees. There's just nobody sitting at the table saying, you know, you need legal counsel on this, here is legal counsel available to you. They don't have the resources internally except for what the employer is going to offer them, and I just don't think that that's not always in the best interest of the employee.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Gilliam, representing National Federation of Independent Business, representing 14,000 small businesses here in the state of Oregon. Here tonight, in opposition to Senate Bill 1198, if I might take a minute, Mr. Chair, on your question just previously to the Attorney General regarding the lawsuit and the your interest in the reserves of State Corporation. I serve for 8 years as the co-chair of the steering committee for the class that sued the state on that issue. One small correction to previous testimony is it wasn't SAFE that won the negotiation settlement, it was the class itself, and I was one of the key signers on that agreement and negotiations in that process. I bring to you 8 years' experience on the ins and outs of the legalities. I'm not an attorney, but I have been schooled on this because we negotiated the deal. And the question is very complex. Mr. Davies is correct as you look at this. But in the most simplest terms, when the legislature took the $81 million in 1982, they came in and said that at that time the statute said that you, the legislature, as a body, did not have an interest in the surplus of State Corporation. Special session came and you wrote the law and said we do have an interest in the surplus of the of State Corporation, and really more to the point, the Industrial Accident Fund, which is the fund they manage. That is legal to do. You can do that. There's no problem with that. The courts are very, very clear that once you set that time, that point when you pass the bill as an emergency clause, you have an interest in everything put in the reserve and attributable to the reserve after 1982. What we attempted to do was say, we've got the 1982, now we want to reach back and change the deal and take the money. You can't do it retroactive. You can do it prospectively. Now, I've heard many people talk about, well, we can reach in and grab the money now because we know what's there. It's not that simple. You have to determine, like the $80 million that you're going to make a payment that goes back into the Industrial Accident Fund this time has to be made. And those are deemed, if there was a rubber stamp, they'd all say pre-1982 on every one of those $80 million. So they have to go back into the fund to recoup what they did here. And then you have to have an actual assessment to determine what amount of money, based on their investment income and the events since 1982, can be attributed to post-1982, come to a number and say, we have an interest in that number. Now, sounds fairly easy. I can tell you that when you start talking to an actuary, two and two is exactly. And it can be very dicey. And that is the legal questions that you'll get involved with if you pursue a public policy of taking those funds. It can be done. You could do it. It would be legal to do it. The question is, at what number? And that's the trick. And very dicey. I just warn you of that. But the courts have been very clear on what.
I'm not suggesting you do it. I just want a clarification on that. I've heard that that was possible.
There's your playing field.
Okay.
It's a risky game, so.
We're doing a cool 10 years long and stayed out.
There was a lot of money you had to pay. Interest, it's amazing what the interest does over that period of time. Boggles of mine. Directly to the bill, Senate Bill 1198, we are concerned and are a little bit in a puzzlement, as Mr. Manaz said, over the need for this bill. We are, as NFIB, we'd like to bring a workers' compensation product to the state for our members. And currently we are sitting on the sidelines because we cannot be competitive with the way the state fund operates. However, as we've gone through this discussion over the last few days, there's been three bills up regarding SAFE and the competitive nature, and we've heard testimony. I provided you with a copy of the statements made by SAFE in the other hearings. And frankly, and the quote, the SAFE representative is, in concluding the statements on the SAFE study, they say, where's the problem? SAFE is causing the workers' compensation market to function exactly as the legislature has intended. As stated to the House committee, don't study us. It's not a problem. Leave us alone. But we're here tonight looking at least 10 major changes to how they operate. And it has to be one or the other. Now, if the policy of the state is to operate a tax-free entity that has an advantage for a purpose, that's fine. We made that policy. We made that decision. Let's do that. But let's make it fair for a three-way market. This bill takes you, in many aspects, as you look at Section 5, taking really away all the decisions from the Investment Council on their reserves and how they invest them. When you take them omit them from the public records law, even though they're a public corporation, you can no longer look at how they operate their business or request that. The question that has come up of having their own private counsel and they can to be sued independently, or they could even sue the state. You could have government suing government, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Those are concerns. Underneath there, they have the authority to create, for sections 10, 11, and 12, an entirely new payroll reporting system, other than what small businesses already do now, to accommodate them, rather than to accommodate the employer. The access to PERS, as Mary talked about. We're taking almost all the steps in this bill to be a private company, except for giving away the advantage of the tax-free investments, which is a huge issue in a competitive market. And it appears to me either you stay status quo, or you take the big leap, you go all the way. And it's one or the other. That's one thing. We support HGR 57 because it studies that issue and should value the company to decide if it's time for the evolution of states to become just a private carrier. This just increases our heartburn on being competitive in the market. You know, less control, all the same advantages financially, and they get to operate more in the dark. That just doesn't seem like a good policy. Now, I brought with me today Jeff Cook. He is our National Workers' Compensation Services Manager for NFIB. We're in 34 states providing services. If you have any questions on how we operate and how we interact with other state funds and other competition and those types of things, he is a good source and an expert in that field if you have those types of questions.
So you didn't mention the fact that they wanted to come in under the insurance code, which is 7 years before.
We would if they want to come in the whole. If you want to come in under the code, and you want to come in under every provision of the code, and the way I read that section, particularly section 13, there's a lot of questions I have to all the selective codes rather than just coming in and saying we're going to be exactly like every private carrier. I mean, you get in the pool, or you don't.
And if they did that, that would be something you would support, probably. Is that correct?
If they would come under the code as everybody else, yes. I mean, under the same set of rules, absolutely. Our biggest concern, however, Mr. Chair, is the ability of the tax-free investment income, and I think Mr. Telfer alluded to it. Mm-hmm. You have around 225, in that area, less than $230 million in premium in 1997, and $192 million in investment tax-free income. And that's pretty close. And we have an issue about how that's used in the competitive market, and we don't believe this bill advances that. And we're concerned that on one side, if they don't touch us, and the other side, they say we need all these changes. It doesn't seem to...
If it did make us all less taxable, then it would just go back to Washington, D.C. It doesn't really...
Well, I would have a case to make us all taxable. We're easy. You know, and it's not an easy problem to solve.
Mm-hmm.
But
my understanding is if you make an exception and say, well, there's an offset, then you stop being a tax-free organization. If you say those earnings have to go for some other purpose, that's my understanding, that you can't do that and keep your tax-free status.
Well, as we've been doing a little research on the federal tax law, on the books, it basically says if you're going to have the tax-free status, you have to be insured of last resort. However, the federal government is very reluctant in enforcing that because they don't want to be down sticking their nose in the state's business, and they aren't very successful at doing that. And I understand that argument because this is a state system, it's a state issue. But there are still some expectations made in a philosophical expectation is all it is, that if we give you the tax break, you're going to perform a special function. I believe that 1198 takes us away from that kind of trade-off.
So how do you justify if we change the cost of doing business for state, which you're suggesting, we raise their cost of doing business because just to make it more competitive with other insurance companies, then you're going to raise the rates that your people you represent, the small business person who is insured with SAFE or whoever it might be, if the cost of doing business for SAFE goes up, the rates go up, and your people will be affected negatively. How do you get around that discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm not really suggesting to take away, I mean, if you want to sell them, yeah, you'll take away the tax. Exactly. We want to make sure that we just compete fairly if you keep SAFE status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just take that argument. You sell SAFE and you put them out there. I agree. Raising taxes raises the cost of doing business. But there is a misnomer out there that if SAFE's expenses go up, Hartford, who is our current insurance partner, rates go up. Our rates don't go up. We don't have to change our rates because SAFE's costs increase any more than we would change our rates if SAFE had a real lousy experience here. They had a lot of accidents and we didn't. We wouldn't raise our rates because their costs went up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
but wouldn't the rates for the people that take insurance, wouldn't their rates go up?
Mr. Hill, that's our concern, is that we have to make sure that the competitive market is healthy, that carriers would like to come into Oregon but don't come in because of the nature of the fund and their abilities. What you want to do is have more carriers, and you don't want just the FIB coming in. You want 3 or 4 or 5 behind us.
Mm-hmm.
So if you change SAFE, the policy change, whatever happened to SAFE, they could have a choice to go and shop their insurance wherever they want. And we don't have that today.
Okay, but my understanding again is that SAFE's market share has gone from 37% to 31%, which means there are other companies coming into the market and writing more insurance. If they have such an advantage, why would their market share be going down?
Mr. Chair, for what we're concerned with, we are our average premium across the country in our 34 states is $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
In the $10,000 premium and less market, SAFE has 70%, by their own testimony, has 70% of that market. They dominate the market because they chase out competition in that market.
Mm-hmm.
So whether they have 31% or 38%, and Mr. Davies testified today that they're always going to have between 30 and 40%, basically, and it's going to go up and down, it's cyclical, they're going to ride the waves up and down. They still have 70% of the market that we're trying to compete in to service our members. And no carrier should have 70% of the market. NFIB shouldn't come in and have 75% of the market. That's not what a healthy competitive market's about. So those numbers are, you know, when you have to break them down to, it's easy to have fluctuations in the $100,000 account. Everybody wants those. You know, you don't have to wave a flag too hard at insurance companies and say, geez, I got $150,000 in premium. Do you want to write me? It's competing in that lower market where we have to service our members. Our members are small. We don't have those big accounts. And so the market share, you have to break down the segments.
Joe, you talked about the different, what Hartford now charges as a premium. I'm wondering if you can compare, and what SAFE charges. Can you tell me what the current difference between Hartford, the premium at Hartford, and SAFE is?
If you wouldn't mind, I defer that to Mr. Cook, as he deals with all our programs across the board and comparing the markets.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jeff Cook with the NFIB. Mr. Chairman, Senator Qtub, it's difficult for me to place an exact figure on where we would be overall on the accounts, the differences between what Hartford would charge and what SAFE is currently charging because of the dividend plans. It would be dependent on the size of the risk, the nature of the business that they're performing, and the dividend plan that they would be participating in. What I know is currently Hartford has around 4% market share, and that while that market share is growing, they're still not a large player in terms of the overall market share. So short story is, I can't give you an exact figure as to what the differences would be.
I'm not really looking for an exact figure. I'm looking for an example. And I'm wondering, I guess my question is the Hartford premium a lot higher than the state's premium?
The basic premium would be higher, probably I would estimate, again, an estimate of 10%. And then, you're looking at additional differences that would be based on the performance of the individual account, but could be 12% or more in dividends.
Is there a lot of variables? The rates are set by the PCI, but then there's rating, depending on the actions they've had.
And it also varies from carrier to carrier based on their expense ratio and different.
The reason I was asking that was because of what Joe was saying about the fact that Hartford's rates won't change if Safe is, Safe has to begin paying taxes. And so that's why I wanted to know, even right now, if you were to compare it.
It's dividends that makes a difference.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Q-Dub, Senator Earp is absolutely right. Rates are not set by Safe. They're set by NCCI, and this is wild, more wild than you can imagine, but they set a pure premium rate for a roofing or a clerk, and we all start there, and then every company goes through a process on their experience and comes up with a rate based on a lot of different factors. If you're in a group program, it's different than if you're an individual company buying it, and some carriers are stronger than others in particular markets. It's hard
and
to give you that.
I really didn't expect to actually get a real premium because I know that there are those things that have to be figured. I guess what I was looking for is how much less is Safe? How much does it keep the market down? I mean, for those who buy insurance from Safe versus the other companies. And the question was with respect to what you said about even if state premium goes up or if they start paying taxes, whatever, they're cut loose, Hartford's premium doesn't change. So,
and Mr. Chair, thank you to, we're tied more to those pure premium rates, which are affected more by the loss. What's the definition of compensability? How many claims come onto the overall perspective from Oregon? So we're tied to that, not rather watching what Safe does up or down. I mean, you watch every carrier because you got to be competitive in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But now Safe will argue that they drive rates. Now that's an honest disagreement of opinion between private carriers and Safe Corporation. They believe they drive rates with their mission, and we're here to tell you that our program is not going to go up or down because Safe is. I mean, we're not coming into the market. We're not. Our rates aren't going down because Safe's rates and dividends are where they're at. We're saying you can't compete against that, and you have a three-way market. We just want a fair shot.
Any other questions? Are we confused? Okay.
I can go on a longer if you want to be confused.
So thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Do you have anyone else that wants to testify on this bill today? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1198. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. It's Dave Honeycutt and John Chandler. What do you think of that? My question is, are they going to take a lot of that surplus money and make it to the bill of one case or maybe?
Yeah. I don't. Well, the way I read the bill, I don't know. It doesn't say all the prospectors on the floor. It actually gets there.
Hi. Are you on the list too? Do you want to come up and hear too?
I'm fine. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. really warm in here, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
It's horrible.
I am other than summer.
Yeah.
So it could be
everybody.
That could be a wide open.
Yeah.
Boy, I'll give it to you. As long as it's by getting in. Because we've got the six books.
I know.
One way to get rid of it. That's interesting. I'm sitting at the same place I sit for land use. Well, it was a movie if you
Is this deja vu, but it starts out?
Who wants to start?
I'll go ahead and start.
You lost our audience, so you have to do it again.
Yeah, well, what happened to 1,000 Friends? They've got to close everything.
I had to watch it.
I don't think that's the land use system. Chair Durfler, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 1061. The aim and intent of Senate Bill 1061 is to make, I call it the fair share bill. What we're trying to do is make sure that when a city imposes a systems development charge on new development to offset infrastructure needs caused by the new development, let's say they need additional water capacity or additional traffic capacity or something of that nature, that they do so in a manner so that the new folks pay essentially the amount needed to offset those improvements and not more. If you have an apartment unit or apartment complex that's being sited in the city of Lake Oswego, for example, and as a result of that apartment complex, they need some street improvements, then we believe that it's the responsibility of the person putting in the development to pay for those street improvements. At the same time, if they want street improvements, if you build an apartment complex in Northwest Portland and the city of Portland says, well, we'll go ahead and approve your apartment complex, but in exchange for that approval, you're gonna make traffic improvements down on Southeast 82nd. We don't believe that that's the responsibility of the person putting in the units over in Northwest Portland. So the goal and the aim of Senate Bill 1061 is to make sure that the local governments charge the minimum amount necessary to offset the impact, the development impact caused by a new development. I've talked with both the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. I know we've got a representative from the league here. They have some suggested language, or we've been talking about some suggested language changes. I'd be more than happy to work with those folks to try and craft a bit of
addressing. You put an apartment house and you've got quite a few more families with children. Would that apply to schools as well? Because you'd have to build another school because of apartment houses. Would that be included in the cost of doing these services you're talking about? Or?
Senator Chair Durfler, not under current law.
We could amend this, so.
Okay.
Great relating clause. Okay, out
there. Would you adjust the systems development charge for each project?
Chair Durfler, I believe that FDCs are controlled by the Dolan case. The Dolan case, the Dolan versus City of Tigard U.S. Supreme Court case, 1994, requires local governments to charge or to have a rough proportionality standard between the impacts of a development and the charges to offset those impacts. There has to be a relationship between whatever you build and whatever the city demands in exchange for approving your permit.
But wouldn't the additional students that would be required for school, wouldn't that be an impact?
Chair Durfler, I'll turn that over to Mr. Chandler. He can school SECs are he can answer that question.
Tell me what the impact. What do you mean by impact?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Chandler, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association. If I understand your question correctly, Mr. Chairman, you're asking if school kids be included in the term impact.
I'm just trying to get an idea of what you mean by the word impact. Would it be just traffic, roads, or would it
be... Well, under Oregon laws, system development charges are allowed for water, sewers, transportation, and parks.
Okay.
sewer.
Is that going to be used for?
Yes, sir. Both storm and sanitary sewers. They're not allowed for schools, fire, police, libraries, comma, by God, period.
And, okay. And, but that, those impacts are there for police and fire and so on, aren't they?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just saying, there are also taxpayers to pay for those things, the fire, the soil.
First place. There are bonds that you often see on your deal.
What?
We're segueing into prisons here, are we?
What?
Oh my God, look at the time.
Okay, but, go ahead. That's the limitation we can use SUS for.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, just by a little bit of history, perhaps, might help the committee with the issue in the bill. The Citizen Building Charge Law was passed in 1989, and it was a joint effort between the home builders and the cities and counties in an attempt to get our hands on around the issue of impact fees. They're called impact fees in most parts of the country. We call them system development charges for reasons that I'm not entirely clear about. And the reason they're limited to water, sewer, streets, and parks is essentially because those are facilities that need to be in place before the development occurs. And in Oregon, we've made the cut to say that things that have to precede development should and can and should be paid for by that development. Things that follow development, which would be the school, the fire, the police, properly come by virtue of the tax base. And that is the decision the legislature's made many times. And that's the basis upon which the bill is predicated, is that structure of system development charges. We supported SDCs in 1989. We continue to support the concept of SDCs, although we reserve the right on any particular case to come in and grumble, sometimes grumbling fairly loudly about them. The reason for that is that under our current fiscal structure, SDCs are about the only way a local government has to raise money for infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And we understand that. We also understand from the builder standpoint that if we don't have infrastructure, we get moratoriums, a cessation of development, which we tend to think is, by and large, a worse thing than paying the SDC. That being said, I think this bill serves a way to highlight a couple of very important issues. One is that in a number of communities around this state, including recently, Mr. Chairman, in the city of Salem, there was an attempt made to impose the maximum allowable SDC, allowed by law. That was an initiative petition that was defeated. The city of Sisters has adopted such a requirement. Other jurisdictions are looking at it. In every jurisdiction that I'm aware of, that discussion is being driven not by a need for money for infrastructure, nearly so much as it is, by a desire to stop wealth. And a feeling that if we just apply enough money and enough cost for people buying new homes and building new businesses, then they will go away. Which may be a perfectly good theory if it's somewhat short-sighted. I think this bill, by talking about the minimum amount necessary, would serve as a message that the legislature does not believe that that would be a good strategy and a good tactic. That what we're talking about here is building infrastructure necessary to serve the development, but not in such a way that we try to drive the development someplace else. And the second point, it's not directly addressed by this bill, but it's certainly, I think, an important topic. And I would like to say that we have another bill in the House dealing with SDCs that we're working with the League and the counties on that will be probably coming across, making some changes in SDC law. And both the cities and counties are very sympathetic and understanding of the issue I'm about to talk about, I believe. We're just all struggling with how to deal with it. And that is that an SDC is a very imperfect way of collecting money. And it's imperfect because it typically will get added into the price of the home, and then the mortgage will be applied to that, and a real estate commission, and financing costs, and builder's costs, and on and on. And we ran rough calculations for the city of West Lynn, where they have I think it's $11,000 SBC total package, which I believe to be probably a pretty fair number considering what they're buying with it. But that $11,000 SBC costs the home buyer $48,000 by the time over a 30-year mortgage and a 7% interest rate. There, and what we're struggling with, and as I say, the cities and the counties, I believe, are sympathetic with this problem, trying to figure out how we can get West Lynn and the other cities and counties in Oregon their $11,000 or whatever it is without it costing $37,000 on top of it. And I think any bill that talks about the need to keep those costs down, to keep the expenses down, to focus on paying for the infrastructure in the most efficient way possible is a good discussion to have. And I would appreciate the chance to start that conversation here and to broach the topic. Again, we believe this bill is a good start in that conversation. Thank you for the hearing.
Thank you.
Does that take any questions you might have?
John, if this bill were to pass, would the $11,000 FCC and what was it? Would it go down?
Mr. Chairman, I am not familiar enough with the Westland ordinance to speak very authoritatively, but I would doubt it.
What about Salem? I know they have a high FCC now.
And Mr. Chairman, they do, and they're about to make it higher, I understand, or at least they're discussing that. I'm not trying to dodge the question, but it would be very difficult without examining the particular FCC ordinance to say whether this would have that effect. It would certainly, I think, operate as a brake on local governments adopting the FCC. Our position on FCCs historically has been, when we've dealt with cities and counties adopting them, again, we understand that if we don't pay it, there isn't another course out there. The infrastructure survey is not likely to come by anytime soon. So if we don't pay it, it won't happen. We don't get the building permit. We just argue with them about how much they charge. This bill would give us an extra tool, I suspect, to have that argument on whether or not the system they're putting in place is the minimum they need, or can they get by with something else? Can we get a cheaper SDC out of it?
But if you were building a house in West Bend, would they have to prove to you that the impact was $11,000?
Of each house, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
No. The way it works is the jurisdictions would adopt the FCC methodology under current law, even with this bill passing, that would make a assessment of what the number of houses expected to be built or businesses, their impact on the particular system, water, sewer, streets, and then calculate a fee based on the capital improvement plan of the jurisdiction, what they thought they needed the money for to handle that development, and then it's a mathematical calculation based on the number of units.
If it didn't change the $11,000, that didn't change the rate the seller was going to pay, what would the bill do then?
Maybe this is going to be a question.
I think I can answer that, as Chair Gerfler. I believe the proof in the methodology with any systems development charge, the local government establishes the methodology under Chapter 223 of the statutes, and that determines how much they're going to charge, and they have a methodology for each of the different types of SDCs that they'll charge. So they'll have a parks methodology, a traffic methodology, and so on and so forth. I think the challenge, if there's going to be a challenge under this bill, would occur at the time that the methodology is adopted. So that you would go in and say, you know, you're asking for things in your methodology that aren't the result of new development. They're things that the city wants, but they're things that essentially benefit the existing residents that the existing residents don't want to pay for. And you're trying to foist the costs off onto the new folks in town. And that's where, I think that's where this bill would come into play.
It would have some regulation on the FUCs that were being proposed by cities and counties and so on.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I thought you were asking, would the $11,000 FUC currently being charged be reduced automatically by the bill? And it would not. It would go to the methodology.
Justify that. The methodology that they used to get from 11,000 was legitimate.
Correct.
Okay. So you could challenge what $11,000 that doesn't being charged or what Salem is charging. They would have to show you that how they got to that amount and to make sure that the impact which is constructed had was under that amount of dollars. But kind of what I'm hearing.
I'm not sure if you could challenge an existing SDC because there's a statutory time for challenging those that would have passed in the case of a Salem or West Lynn. But if Salem came through with another SDC or an increase or modification of the existing one, then this would apply. To a certain extent, an SDC is a contract of sorts. It would be very difficult to come back in, I believe, and challenge what was already in place. But it would apply to anything coming up new.
Community, if they decide that they need more housing, there are things going on and there's a shortage and they need to take care of that, or they foresee one coming, they can either not institute FCC charges or suspend them, can't they, in order to accommodate?
There's no requirement in Oregon that you have an FCC. Right.
So if Westland decided that they really needed more housing, they wouldn't have to charge the SDCs that they're charging.
Correct.
Now, it looks to me like
by talking about the minimum fees, those who either at some point believe they need to increase their fees, because eventually that will happen to all those who have them, or institute them, you're likely to come in and say, we only need a two-lane road, we don't need bicycle paths and sidewalks, you want a 6-inch water line because you expect more building out there later on the adjacent land, but we're not planning to do that, so this development only needs a 4-inch water line. Those kinds of things as they're putting together their development charge. The minimum fees necessary for capital improvement seems to me gives you a great deal of latitude to go in and argue down to the two-lane road with no bicycle paths or sidewalks.
Mr. Chairman, we do that math. What this bill would do would perhaps give us an extra tool in that argument. But that is part of the SEC methodology is the capital improvement plan. And then
but they still get to make the decision as to what size water line they need and where. I mean, and with this, it wouldn't necessarily be that. And your opportunity to say, we can handle this and this, but if you go that far, we sue, would be right out there.
I think the answer or the point that needs to be made on that question is we're not saying that you can't have the bike path. We're not saying that you can't have the 6-inch water pipe. All we're saying is who should pay for that. Should the existing residents pay for that or should the new residents pay for that?
If a city decided that, and I assume that most of these developments are coming up with more than you believe they ought to have, or you wouldn't be here. So if they wanted the bicycle paths and the sidewalks and they wanted the 6-inch water line, you have the opportunity with this bill to go in and say, we can handle the water line, but if you want to go to all those other improvements, we'll see you in court. Because you now have legal language that says that they can't charge more than minimum necessary.
That's correct.
That's a private talk. You don't have to lift these chairs. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an excellent example of this, I think, and that's the property we have in Lake Oswego that happens to be next to a railroad track, and so there's a road running along that that tees off. Well, we've got a large corner lot, and if you go to the left, it's dead end, fairly quickly, actually. And so the only way you can go is to the right. Well, we had a choice. The city wanted us to put in single-family housing. And so, but they would allow a sixplex. So what they said was, if you put in a sixplex, you have to put in a right turn lane and take up some of your property. Well, this is not a heavily traveled street. The only way you really will ever turn is right, and yet to use that annoyance to go above and beyond what is reasonable, they threw in that requirement, almost hoping that we would have to sue and expend money doing that. And I would like this tool to walk in there and say,
We made a wish they could have said you have to make a left hand.
But actually, they required more. There's no sidewalks in the entire neighborhood. There are no curbings in the entire neighborhood. We're going to require, for that only, somebody subdivided the next lot over, put in 4 new houses, but they were single-family houses. They didn't require that they put in sidewalks. But for us, we're going to have to put in curbings and sidewalks. I mean, I would love to have this extra ammunition to go into court and take on a government like that.
I guess I just would like a little bit of help understanding how, although we have talked about the system development charges and basically how the municipality or whatever comes up with what they're going to charge, but John, when you were saying that in West Lynn, they figured that it was $11,000 per house, and then in turn that cost the, over time, the homeowner $48,000. But do they, how do they normally come up with a methodology to charge X amount of dollars? Is it project by project? Or is there some kind of a dollar figure for certain things?
It's literally all over the map in the Q-Tub. It is not project by project. What it is driven by is the capital improvement plan the jurisdiction has for whichever system they're talking about, water, sewer, streets, parks. They'll come up with a plan. The SDC, by law, has to relate to that plan and then relate to the impact of new development. So in a very simplistic sense, it's the cost of the plan divided by the number of houses or businesses. And a jurisdiction, we don't cap SDCs in Oregon, so the jurisdiction is free to charge as much or as little down to zero of that plan as they choose. And in West Lynn, the example there, the part I was most familiar with was the water system because of the topography there. It costs a lot more to put in run water system than it would in a flatter area.
Mm-hmm.
Some jurisdictions in Oregon have zero SDCs. Some have actions creeping up over 15,000 now. But in each case, it just simply depends on what they believe they need to serve new development and what they think they're going to get in the way of new development. What this bill talks to is the first part of that calculation. What is it you need to have in place to serve with the new development?
And that was part of the misunderstanding. When I hear this, the title, the service development cost, that's what I expect them to be charging per project. I'm showing my ignorance here. I did not know that they just, we need this, that, and the other thing, and then determine by that what they're going to charge. So I can see why a developer might have made.
If I may, and I'll, in deference to my colleagues from the cities here, I don't want to leave the impression that they necessarily dream this up.
No,
in the evening.
Yeah.
Because there are ITE manual for transportation, there's another book of wizardry for water and sewer, and it's they won't let me look at it. It's locked away in a vault someplace in Switzerland, but yeah, we have another bill to talk about that. But they are driven by actual real numbers, and the question. And what we're trying to get at here is a bit of a fine-tuning, I'll grant, but what we're trying to get at is it is real tempting for a jurisdiction to see, and this is by no means the norm, and so forth, she pops me again, to see SDCs as free money. And there's always a temptation. Not many succumb to it. But in the political sense, the people who pay SDCs in the future don't know they're going to yet because they haven't made the decision to buy a new house or open a new business. Therefore, they're pretty easy to go after as opposed to the folks who already live there. And we have seen examples where jurisdictions have gone beyond what they needed. I remember one is a jurisdiction in Central Oregon, and we were able to talk them out of it without this bill, but this bill would have made it easier, who wanted to, as part of their park plan, put in a model airplane flying facility. Now, I suspect that would have been a good thing to have, and we were able to convince them that unless they could document and prove that people who lived in new houses were more likely to fly model airplanes than people who lived in existing housing, they would probably have a hard time explaining that in court. And they agreed, and we didn't have to go get fancy. But that's always the temptation. And so what this bill, I think, is trying to address that. And again, it isn't that every jurisdiction wants to go out there and put in Italian Swiss marble in the bottom of the cash basis, but there are a couple who have thought that would be a good idea. Naming no names.
Yeah, you have to defend the whole direction.
So there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon. I'm one of the people to whom Mr. Chandler grumbles on a regular basis, and I listen. We see the language of this bill as more draconian and with farther-reaching impacts than the proponents have discussed. And let me just tell you a little bit about what our concerns are. We are opposed to it in this form. We're happy to talk about specific issues. And I think if you want to have a discussion about what should growth pay for, because, remember, these things are being driven by growth and new development, then we should have that discussion. But we don't think that this bill is the vehicle to have that necessarily.
limiting STCs may make development less expensive. It may also have some unintended consequences. And as John pointed out, that the city that can't come up with money to take the development from where the development ends to where the city already has existing infrastructure, they're out of luck. Theoretically, the development would come to a stop. And there is a method now within the STC ordinances and language of the law to allow developers to actually come up with that money and get credits on future development. As we read this bill, that would bring that to a stop. Another concern we have is what we see as a lack of specificity in this minimum capacity language in the bill. If, for example, there's a minimum need to deal with a specific development that would require a 4-inch water line, which you were talking about, Senator Dukes, and the city projects based on what it sees coming down the road for development that a 6-inch line is needed, there's two ways you could go about it. Either the city would have to come up with the rest of the money, which in some areas that may be possible, but in other areas it certainly would not be, and so the development couldn't go forward, or you'd end up building twice. You put in the 4-inch line, and then when the new development came in, you'd end up spending money again, and we're not sure that that's in anyone's interest, either the developers or the citizens who will be moving in and the citizens who are already there. We're also concerned that minimum facility may be read in such a way that you would be losing the economies of scale that you have when you look at the larger picture and figuring out what you need to do and designing your STCs to fit into that picture. And there's also a question of interpretation about minimum standards. Are they the city standards? Are they DEQ standards? Government unit in the bill is not particularly clear, and we're concerned about that. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't tell you that the infrastructure ferry has not come to cities, that the Department of Economic Development worked with us, and we surveyed both rural and urban infrastructure needs. Together we came up with a projection of over $2 billion in unmet infrastructure needs over the next 4 to 5 years. And this is just water, wastewater, not roads, not schools, not public facilities, just those basic needs. And the shortfall that economic development came up with, and that took all of the existing funding programs into account, over the next two years was $100 million. So
that's for the people that already are living there.
This is for all of our infrastructure needs in our communities and in rural Oregon. So STCs do not pay the whole bill by any means. There is a tremendous need out there that has to be.
We don't have a program going to offset this shortfall you already have. You're not going to charge the people that are already living in that community a fee to correct that shortfall, but you would expect when they're building a new house to help offset that shortfall.
Mr. Chair, the city will do both to the extent that it can. You know, the STCs are part of the equation. Obviously, bonding is another part of the equation, and sometimes not doing anything and deferring maintenance or, you know, not meeting the infrastructure needs and dealing with the other side of the problem is the way you're forced to deal with that lack of money issue because couldn't make the representation that cities expect new growth to do to solve all the problems by any means. You know, some cities they consider it to create a problem. But STCs are only one part of the picture, and we think we really need to look at the whole part of infrastructure funding if we're going to discuss those issues and where STCs fit into that. We think there are some underlying tenets of STCs that, you know, John has talked about that come from the way the bill came into being 10 years ago, the way it's been through the course of this, and what is expected to be met by STCs and what is not, and how we should think about those things. Again, if there are specific issues, we're happy to talk about them and come up with a better way of doing things. But we don't think that this bill is the vehicle to do that. So
you'd rather we didn't pass this bill.
We would rather you didn't pass it.
Is there some parts of the bill that are good?
I think the questions that are being raised, Mr. Chair, are reasonable questions. I'm not sure that the language of this bill gets to those questions. For example, I'm working with Mr. Chandler on another bill that more specifically defines how we look at parks STCs and what the new people are expected to pay for versus the current residents and how that gets specified. That's a specific area where there could be, at least he has expressed concerns, and we understand those concerns and would like to work on them. This minimum capacity in this bill is really concerning to us. We would prefer to see it structured in a way that doesn't raise so many questions and, in our minds, doesn't get to the heart of SDC, because we really see this as changing the way things have been dramatically.
Could you work with Mr. Chandler to make it an accessible bill?
I would certainly be happy to work with anyone, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if it'd be acceptable to the cities, but I'm certainly happy to work with anyone.
I would suggest that maybe you ought to take a look and see if you can reach some agreement on it that be accepted to the both sides. Okay, could we do that and take a look at it? Okay. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you have any questions?
Just a comment, because back to the 4- and 6-inch pipe, seems to me the city's almost double dip on this one, because here I am, 4-inch pipe is quite satisfactory for me and my neighborhood, and I'm willing to put that in, but I'm required to put a 6-inch in, because further down the road somebody's going to come and build further. Well, they're going to have to pay a system development charge too, so the city's getting that. Plus, they're getting me to provide the equipment necessary so that we can have that future development. As far as I'm concerned, that's double dipping. I mean, doing it properly and equitably, I will put in what is necessary to serve my property. That would be very equitable because in my neighborhood, we're watching the other result, which is not just paying those system development charges, but because of various problems with our sewer system, we're putting in a whole new sewer system. Well, not only are there the costs associated with this, which if I'm going to build a house in the area, I may be involved in having to pay, but also my sewer bill is going up dramatically. There are other ways of recouping the cost as well. That can happen with your water bill as well. So there are other avenues for the local government to get their funds, and it's not just this.
Mm-hmm.
I like the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to Senator Wilde's comment there, and I can't give you legal advice, but Oregon law does provide for a credit against SDC payments for oversizing facilities. So and we put that in the law with the city's help in 1993, I believe. So if your property requires, and hypothetically here, a 4-inch water line, and you end up installing a 6-inch as part of the conditions of approval, you would be able to get credit for the difference in cost between what it costs for your service versus the larger. That can be a very good thing, particularly with roads, where it can be a pretty good chunk of money.
How is that credit recovered?
It depends on the jurisdiction. Well, normally it can be either credit against the FTC you would otherwise owe. It can be transferred to a future development if you're a professional developer. It can be reimbursed to you through other hookups. We have people going on the line. And different jurisdictions handle different ways. But if you're in that position, you might want to know that.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, too, because of the example Senator Duke brought up, it would seem to me that if a city would require that 6-inch pipe, even for future development, that they should participate in the cost of that, because they're the one that's going to say that the other land can be developed that isn't yet. So in a sense, they're doing that.
Right, there is a credit reimbursement arrangement.
Well, I would like to ask you to get together and see if you can reach a common.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
And come back to us maybe next week. Just give us some ideas of where we
can. Sure. Sure.
You don't want this bill, maybe you can tell us what bill you want.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That we're going to close the public hearing on 1061. And with that, we're going to adjourn.
I was going to say,
there is
that
we're going to
Very good.